This is Culturetopia, your weekly roundup of arts and culture from National Public Radio. I am Neda Ulaby, reporter for NPR's Arts Desk.
And I'm Sonari Glinton, the producer for All Things Considered.
Just a reminder, you can subscribe to this podcast at npr.org/Culturetopia. This week,
we hear from author Don DeLillo about his new novel, Point Omega.
A new series of films depicts the grisly tale of Northern England's Yorkshire Ripper.
And the dance party TV show, Soul Train, turns 40. But first,
in our year-long series, 50 Great Voices, NPR asks this question: what makes a voice great? We turn now to this voice.
Soon we'll be done. Trouble of the world. Trouble of the world.
It belongs to gospel legend Mahalia Jackson. If the civil rights movement had a soundtrack, you would no doubt find Jackson's name and voice again and again. She sang at Selma, at the March on Washington, and at Martin Luther King Jr.'s funeral. And what's drawn so many to Mahalia Jackson's voice then and now is its authenticity. Sonari, you did the profile of Jackson for our series. Let's take a listen.
When you hear the voice, you know the woman.
And that's where the power comes.
Reverend Jesse Jackson.
And there is no gap between what you say and who you are, what you say and what you believe. And when you can express that through song, it is all of the more powerful.
Move on upward, higher, Lord. Meet with old man Daniel. Move on upward, higher, Lord. Meet with the Hebrew children. Move on upward, higher, Lord. Meet with Paul and Silas. Move on upward, higher, Lord. Meet my loving mother.
Beginning in the 1940s, Mahalia Jackson was one of the first singers to take gospel out of the church, drawing white audiences and selling millions of records. She inspired generations of singers like Aretha Franklin and Mavis Staples. You know, I'll take you there, of the Staples singers. Mavis Staples says Mahalia Jackson's success didn't always go over well back home in the black church.
The ministers in the churches here didn't want her singing in their church because she would put a beat to these traditional gospel songs. She would, you know, they would say she's singing the blues. Just like How I Got Over. You see, the church would sing, How I Got Over, How I Got Over, my Lord. And Sister Mahalia Jackson would say, How I Got Over, How I Got Over. You know, my soul, look back and wonder, how did I make it over?
Tell me how.
And when Jackson brought her brand of gospel to the recording studio, it could cause trouble. Music historian Reverend Stanley Keeble tells the story of when she worked with the great producer Mitch Miller.
Mahalia had him pulling out his hair at the recording session because Mahalia had a problem staying within those time measures that he had set. And gospel music is more inspirational than time-induced.
You sing as the spirit hits you.
Definitely.
Jackson could stand up to producers, preachers, and even friends like Louis Armstrong, who begged her to try jazz or pop when she insisted only on singing gospel.
Through the night, take my hand, precious Lord, and leave.
Jesse Jackson says when a young Martin Luther King Jr. called on her during the civil rights movement, she never refused. traveling with him to the deepest parts of the segregated South.
And so she put her career and her faith on the line, and both of them prevailed. And, of course, when we got through with the big meetings, she could cook as good as she could sing.
You know, when food is cooked with love and soul, you can kind of taste it. Mavis Staples says you can so clearly feel the love and faith in Sister Mahalia Jackson's music that listening to this story might cause some distracted driving.
Oh, it might make them stop driving. It might make them pull over to the curb and listen. When the song is finished, I guarantee you they will take a deep sigh.
Let's see if she's right. Sonari Glinton, NPR News.
You know, Sonari, I was so excited to learn that you were doing this because you, like one of Mahalia Jackson's great friends, Ted Turkel, are a Chicago guy, very deeply rooted Chicago guy, as was she.
Yeah, and it was really fun to do a story, being someone from the South Side, to do a story about someone from the South Side. And if you notice, everyone who's in the story is actually on the South Side of Chicago. And there was a strange moment of pride. What, the other thing that I was just thinking about this now was that Mahalia Jackson would have been 100 in next year. And there's still a lot of people who have personal knowledge of her. And it occurred to me is that how she cultivated young people, Mavis Staples, Albertina Walker, Jesse Jackson, like all of these people she fed spiritually and emotionally, like had them over, like all of them had been over her house. And, you know, there's a 30, 40 year age gap between, you know, some of the people in this piece. And I thought that was an amazing thing, and it inspired me to think about how I deal with people who are older and younger than me.
The idea of swiftly passing time is central to Don DeLillo's new book. The author has in the past reimagined John F. Kennedy's assassination, the Cold War, even 9/11. His new book is called Point Omega. In it, a man flees alone to a house in the middle of the California desert. And as DeLillo recently told Steve Inskeep, he flees because he feels the ticking of mortality.
Out in the desert, what he feels is so vast that it doesn't necessarily affect him personally.
Well, you present us with this gray-haired, sort of ponytailed university intellectual thinking really big thoughts in a really big place. And yet he's also remembering or recovering from a really specific recent news event.
You're referring to the war.
This is a man you describe as having been an intellectual who was brought into an administration to help plan what appears to be the Iraq War.
He was, he was part of a series of closed meetings in conference rooms. And what he was intended to contribute was a kind of overarching view, not of specific troop movements, but to give them a deeper idea of how to wage this particular kind of war. And it gives him something to be in retreat from, that is, his experience during those 2 years or so that he spent as a defense intellectual. And his retreat occurs in this desert terrain.
What do you think draws you as a writer who's concerned with really large themes of time and life and death to focus on people who have some connection to public news events?
I think for decades now we've been flooded by media stimulation of one kind or another. And once it becomes part of everybody's life, I think it becomes part of a fiction writer's conceivable subject, at least at some level. It has just seemed to me to be an important element in our lives. And I guess in one sense, my work all these years has been about living in dangerous times. And part of this danger has been what the media reports and how it changes our perceptions.
I'm thinking of a novel of yours that must be more than a quarter century old now, White Noise. I still remember a passage from that book, which I relate to now as a parent, in that There's a father and a son. They're driving in a car. It's dumping down rain. The son says, you're smiling. I'm glad you remember this too. The son says, the radio says it's going to rain tonight. The father says it's raining now. The son says the radio said tonight. You have this conflict between reality and virtual reality.
Yeah, and the conflict is, I think, ever-present. It's something that we breathe in through our pores. It's just part of our perception.
You can hear the full interview at npr.org/culturetopia.
Every once in a while, NPR asks its guests about some of the music that's catching their ear. In this installment, filmmaker Mario Van Peebles, who was on the show Tell Me More to talk about his new documentary, Fair Game, describes some of the songs he's listening to now.
I'm Mario Van Peebles, and right now, what am I listening to? I'm listening to a song called Rosalie's Good Eats Cafe that my dad played for me as a kid. And I'm listening to a lot of country because I'm working in it. It's sort of a film called Black, White, and Blues that's two guys on a spiritual journey, and they go through the heartland. So it's Rosalie's Good Eats Cafe. Interesting song. It's got a nice irony to it. By Bobby Bear.
And the sign on the wall says, in God we trust. All others have to pay. And it's 2 in the morning on Saturday night at Rosalie's Good Eats Cafe.
What country music does is it's sort of like it sees the play of life. And towards the end of the song, you sort of understand that the storyteller is, in fact, on the stage with them, that we're not outside of it. We're inside of it, but the ability to look at it from the outside makes it something you can see with perspective, almost with your third eye.
At 2 in the morning on Saturday night at Rosalie's Goody's Cafe.
I'm also listening to That's My Job, and that's by Conway Twitty. A pretty song. It's got this sort of a father and son story. Nice song.
My world revolved around him. I couldn't lie there anymore. So I made my way down the mirrored hall and tapped upon his door. And I said, Daddy, I'm so afraid. How will I go on?
I just want to say how sweet it is to hear all of these songs about dads that Mario Van Peebles is talking about, because, of course, his father was an acclaimed filmmaker who really has left quite a big footprint still in Hollywood and in the world of, not really in Hollywood, but in the world of independent cinema.
Yeah. I mean, we wouldn't have had a whole generation of guys who decided to make a film on a credit card, you know, or use disability to help pay for their movie, you know, like if it hadn't been for Melvin Van Peebles, Mario's father.
Making films on a budget can be a challenge any place. And there's an ambitious trilogy of British films that have just opened, three of them made for less than $3 million, I believe. Their subject, Northern England at the time of the Yorkshire Ripper, who murdered at least 13 women from 1975 to 1980. The case haunted Yorkshire amid charges of police incompetence and corruption. It also inspired four novels by David Peace that make the foundation for the new films. Pat Dowell has this report.
The Red Riding trilogy takes its title from the fact that the Yorkshire region of England is divided into sections called ridings. And in these stories, the ridings are red with blood. Novelist David Peace was born and raised in Yorkshire. He says it's a place with a fierce regional identity, epitomized in the books and the films by a brutal police force that uses public fear over the murders for its own ends. The police are even a source of terror to possible witnesses.
You don't like the police much, do you?
Well, I've lost, no.
So when someone kicks down your front door, kills the dog and rapes the wife, who are you going to call?
Well, it certainly wouldn't be the West Yorkshire Police. They'd already be in there, wouldn't they?
At the time of the Ripper murders, Yorkshire was also a place of rising poverty and unemployment. James Marsh, who directed the second film of the Red Riding trilogy, says there was great turmoil in the North over the policies of Conservative Prime Minister Margaret Thatcher.
Across the years that she's in power, the welfare state is dismantled. And there's a great, enormous sort of social upheaval, particularly in the north of England, which has this sort of rotting industrial base that is no longer viable in the modern world. And she deals with that very ruthlessly. And so this is the backdrop to, I think, what's sort of going on in the foreground of the three films.
David Peace emphasizes that the books are fiction, but the stories echo reported incidents of British police misconduct at the time. Red Riding portrays a place where brute force is the quickest problem solver. In the first film, two torturers from the local constabulary prepare to toss an interfering young reporter out of a speeding van.
You see this? This is the North. We do what we want.
This is the North. We do what we want is a continuing thread through the trilogy. Adapting Red Riding was a daunting task for screenwriter Tony Grizzoni, who relied on giant wall charts tracing the interconnected stories and characters, the twisting flashbacks, and the fact mixed with fiction. He also struck up a lively email correspondence with novelist David Peace to sort things out.
I trusted David's books, and I always looked to them for the answers to anything. I always looked to them for a turn of phrase. And then beyond that, I would know that David was there on the other end of the computer, and I would ask him a question. And very often, David either couldn't remember or didn't know, and we'd look together for the answer, and sometimes there was no answer, and we'd have to make one up.
Grizzoni also worked with all three directors, including James Marsh, who won an Oscar for his 2008 documentary, Man on Wire. Marsh says it was Grizzoni's screenplays that attracted him to the project.
That's why the films have a coherence across the trilogy, because there's one author who is creating images that rhyme with each other across the three films. That overview that Tony brought to the trilogy was vital and necessary because each director was going to interpret it subject to their own understanding of it. So there wasn't a great deal of collaboration amongst the directors, but the screenplays made the whole venture coherent, I think.
But the way the stories double back to pick up on past events, some of which are never fully explained, is one of the trilogy's strengths, says critic and historian David Thompson.
We are so used to movie stories being cut and dried and tied up neatly with bows on every point, whereas we know that real life is frequently much less tidy, much less organized. And I think there's a place for movie narratives where a good deal is left unsettled.
And, says Thompson, Red Riding's challenging tale of the ragged boundaries between good and evil some 30 years ago never turns away from the truth of our own times.
The full story of the Detroit bomber on Christmas Day, that's a very confused story. And yes, there was a lot of information around. And well, we can't actually be precise about how it did or didn't get through. There's an example of a potentially terrifying situation where we are left in the dark. We are judged not fit to know exactly what happened, where confusion, darkness, mystery, obscurity reigns. What I'm saying is that situations like that, where the public is left to make the best of it, they're going on all the time in liberal parliamentary democracies. We know that there's darkness at every corner. That's what this show says. This show says, don't trust authority. It is not an easy, comfortable, reassuring show. I think if you see the whole thing, however, you will never forget it.
Hollywood won't forget. Ridley Scott has already acquired the rights to squeeze Red Riding into one movie set in the American heartland.
To us all, and to the North.
To the North,
where we do what we want.
For NPR News, this is Pat Dowell.
And now for a reassuring show set in the American heartland.
Yes, exactly. Let's turn from northern England to south side of Chicago.
Hooray, we're back.
Yes, where 40 years ago, kids in Chicago turned on their TV sets to watch Soul Train, which is just such a memory, where you would watch, you know, you'd look and you'd see what they were wearing. I'll never forget one woman having a bandana as a top.
That's what I'm wearing right now.
So, You'd watch Soul Train to learn the dance moves, to learn the latest fashion, to hear what's hip in music. The show's been off the air for a few years now, but as NPR's Karen Grigsby Bates reports, a new TV documentary is getting ready to school a whole new generation.
For years, millions of kids across the country didn't need a calendar to know this. If it was Saturday morning, it was time for Soul Train.
The hippest trip in America. 60 nonstop minutes across the tracks of your mind into the exciting world of soul.
Host Don Cornelius brought some of the country's hottest black recording artists into the nation's living rooms every week.
We're back with the Godfather, James Brown, and James.
Okay, we're back now with Ike and Tina Turner, Marvin Gaye, and Marvin.
Barry White.
I understand your name is Chaka Khan, right?
That's what they call me.
He's the closest the music world has come to having its own messiah, Al Green.
And soul icon Smokey Robinson says Don Cornelius didn't have to beg.
Everybody who was anybody in the entertainment world, as far as the artists went, wanted to be on Soul Train.
That's what made the idea of a documentary on Soul Train's history irresistible to director Kevin Swain. He knew there was a whole group of powerful black artists younger generations needed to hear, even if they had to be told who those people were.
Much of my crew hadn't really heard about Al Green.
I can't believe that it's real.
So I picked a live version of Here I Am, Come and Take Me. Made sure we showed the part when he went to church. And so I had to explain what that meant.
Swain had to school them that this was the same call and response many black folks were used to hearing every Sunday morning in church. And Swain's staff got religion about a number of other performers too, like the Spinners. Bass gorgeousness that was Barry White. Backed by a live orchestra. Back in the day, Soul Train gave white kids who didn't know or live near anyone black an opportunity to see young black culture up close. For black kids who didn't see themselves reflected in the mainstream media, Soul Train was a revelation. Musician Amir Questlove Thompson of The Roots and Late Night with Jimmy Fallon.
The show is very important because historically it's one of the first shows that sold us Afrocentricity.
Don Cornelius, a Chicago radio personality with a potent set of pipes, was the show's creator.
After a short time in radio, the first thing I began to really notice is that there was no black television. That television was just white this, white that, general market this, white that. No TV that targeted our culture.
He found a sponsor for a TV show based on traveling sock hops he put on with local soul performers like Curtis Mayfield, Jerry Butler, and the Shylights.
It gave me a sense of a train traveling from school to school.
And Soul Train was born. In the beginning, it was a hometown show. But when it took off, Cornelius moved the whole operation to Los Angeles and added a feature that became essential to everyone who watched it.
Right now, we'd like to hit you to the Soul Train line. It gives everybody a chance to kind of style a while and something you might want to get into on your own at parties or dances.
The Soul Train dancers showed off the latest moves and the latest fashions. Dancer Jody Watley thanks Soul Train for her successful career as a singer and producer.
70s, 80s. It's really a core nucleus of music and fashion in many ways.
Soul Train ended in 2006, but is set to return in a boxed DVD set in March. Meanwhile, for 60 minutes on Saturday night, viewers can enjoy the best parts of the hippest trip in America, courtesy of VH1's documentary.
Wish you love. Peace.
Karen Grigsby Bates, NPR News.
That's it for this week.
You can find links to all the stories we've heard today and subscribe to this podcast at npr.org/culturetopia. Peace, love, and soul. I'm Sonari Glutton.
And I'm Netta Ulavi. Thanks for listening to Culturetopia. So long.